You have heard me over the years now offer a number of stories about my childhood summers that were spent on my grandfather's small southern Ohio farm. So I'm going to add another one to the pile this morning. I must have been around 10 years old. And one afternoon, I got to rummaging around in this big old storage trunk that was kept up in an outbuilding a little ways away from the main house. And while poking through old letters and old photographs and old Bibles and other such things as that, I dug up what looked like a little coupon book. Most of the coupons had been torn out, but there were still a few of them in there, and I wondered what it was, and so I took it down to the house, and I asked my aunt about it, and she told me it was a ration book. Being an inquisitive type, I had to ask another question, which of course was, well, what is a ration book? And she explained to me that during the war, in this case it was the Second World War, which was only about 10 years distant at that time, she said that certain types of food were scarce in grocery stores, and you had to show this coupon from your ration book if there was a particular food item that you wanted to purchase at a particular time when it wasn't in that much of supply. Well, that struck me as a little odd, since even at that young age, I had already figured out that you could buy whatever you wanted in a grocery store so long as it was on the shelf and you had the money to pay for it. But my question had been answered. So I went and put the book back in the trunk. I put the trunk back where it belonged, as I was told to do, and then I went on with my play. Well, I thought of that incident just a couple years ago when I was interviewing a gentleman for an article that I was writing. The man's name is Al Hinkle. Excuse me. He is the prototype for one of the characters in Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And part of our interview, as I was talking with him, Al began telling me about his early days in Denver, Colorado. And that conversation eventually wound around to how he recounted coming back to Denver after doing a hitch in the United States Merchant Marine during the Second World War. He got in pretty early, and so he was able to come back before the war was over. He had no family to support at that time, and so with the money he'd made in the Merchant Marine, he was able to buy his first car. But as Al told it, rubber was scarce due to the war. So I put my car up on blocks and rode the bus until the war was over. He said this in a very matter-of-fact kind of way, implying there was not such an unusual practice at that time. Well, let's grant the obvious before we go any further. Dealing with a limited level of food rationing or taking the public transit instead of driving your own car for a couple of years are pretty small potatoes when it comes to wartime sacrifices. Small, that is, compared to being on the front lines of a battlefield where you're getting shot at and possibly killed. But these two incidents just cited, and numerous others like them, have given me some kind of insight into that era. I was born right at the end of it, 1945. They provided those kinds of incidents. They provided some sense of continuity or some sense of connection between what was happening at home here in America and what was happening on the battlegrounds of Europe and in the Pacific. These kinds of incidents engendered the notion, the idea that we really are all in this thing together. If this indeed is a war worth fighting, then we all need to be giving up something in order to support it. And there was also the sense that even with all the horrors of warfare, that there was a greater good at stake, for which we should all be willing, as I say, to give up at least a little something. Every sacrifice, great or small, from not driving your car to actually going off to war, was seen as contributing to the greater good of the defeat of unchecked fascism. Well, as you know, we have sent soldiers off to several other wars since then. And those subsequent wars have had mixed support from the American people. Greater support for some, less support for others, when it comes to the rationales offered for them. And some of the soldiers who have fought in those subsequent wars were conscripts, some were and are volunteers. And each of them, each of these soldiers were and are called upon to make the same kinds of sacrifices as did those who went off to World War II. And for some, their sacrifices have been the ultimate ones of their lives. So what then do we say about these lives? Whatever our feelings and opinions may be about the wars in which they fought. What do we say about on this Memorial Day, a day originally set aside with the name of Decoration Day to honor the war dead following the Civil War, and that it has been come a time to honor those who lost their lives in service to their country ever since? What do we especially say now? With the New York Times poll that was released this past Friday that reveals that now over 60% of Americans believe we never should have invaded Iraq. What do we say when opposition to the war we're in now is no longer even a minority position? Well, whatever such opinion polls may show, there are still lives, human lives of young, mostly, men and women, some 3,400 now, that have been lost over the past 4 years or more. And those lives must be honored. And there are lives that have been dramatically altered and the course of lives dramatically reshaped both by physical and psychological wounding that warrant and call for our ongoing care. None of these lives can be ignored. For they went to war with the same commitment, the same dedication, as did my father and my uncle over 60 years ago. Well, when I think about all this, I find myself coming back to and being haunted in many ways by a poem that was written over 60 years ago at the conclusion of the Second World War. It was written by the poet and the playwright Archibald MacLeish. Mr. MacLeish would later achieve Broadway fame and acclaim for his play, J.B. But during World War II, MacLeish had been serving as the Librarian of Congress. And when the war ended, the Library of Congress staff wanted to hold a memorial service for his staff members who had gone off to fight in that war and had not returned. By that time, Archibald MacLeish had already a pretty well-established identity as a poet, writer, man of letters, so he was asked to write the poem. He was in his early 50s at that point, and he had been an artillery officer in the First World War, so he knew about war, and he knew about combat, and he knew about battlefield deaths. He was not, that is to say, writing from an academic ivory tower. And the poem he came up with, the poem he wrote, was called The Young Dead Soldiers. And these are some of its lines. We were young. We have died. Remember us. We have given our lives. But until it is finished, no one can know what our lives gave. Our deaths are not ours. They are yours. They will mean what you make them. Whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and new hope or for nothing, we cannot say. It is you who must say this. We leave you to our deaths. Give them meaning. We were young. We have died. Remember us. What makes this poem so striking for me, in addition to its powerful words, is its context. Remember, it was written following in the wake of a war for which there was probably a greater degree of unity and support across this nation than for any other war we ever fought before or since. And it was one in which, given the examples I've already cited, the American people across the country felt some level of personal participation in themselves. And yet, this poet still wrote, taking the voice of those who had died, Whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope or for nothing, we cannot say. It is you who must say this. Curious words indeed. For in many ways, the meaning of the battlefield deaths of World War II were apparent. My father and one of my uncles, as I already said, served in that conflict. Both of them, fortunately, came home alive and unscathed and lived out their lives and raised their families and pursued their careers and their jobs. I remain proud to this day for what they did for their and for my country. They knew why they went. They knew what their service had meant when they came home. They knew what those who did not come home with them had died for. The rise of fascism in Europe, beginning in Germany, presented not just a threat to the United States, but to many of the world's peoples. And as the assembly line deaths of the concentration camps and the attempted annihilation of Jewish people in Europe became exposed, it became clear that we were, had been, dealing with someone who would stop at absolutely nothing in his perverted quest for a master race. And most important, he had the military means to pursue that twisted vision as far as he could take it. And even in the face of all that, or alongside all that, McClellan wrote the lines, "Whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope or for nothing, we cannot say." Well, one of the marks of a good piece of poetry is that it takes you inside yourself. Takes you inside yourself, makes you think, makes you probe, makes you do a little soul searching. And that's how I have chosen to create or treat this poem of Ecclesiastes that I decided to build a sermon around it this morning. Because I think what he was trying to do there was to go from the particular to the universal, which is also what a good piece of poetry does. It may be written for a particular event, but it's supposed to bring us to some universal understanding or insight on things as well. For Ecclesiastes was raising a question that must be raised at the conclusion or even during the course of any war. Are its deaths for peace and for a new hope, or for not? With this in mind, then, what do we say of American lives lost over these past 4 years and more? For they were lives that were just as precious and just as beloved as those that were lost over 6 decades ago. They're just as precious and just as beloved as those lost in subsequent wars. And they were sent, in this case, to make war on a country that was ruled by someone whose heart and mind and deeds may well have been as hideous as those of Hitler's, but who, despite all we were told by those who took us into it, did not pose a threat to this country and to the world in the way that Adolf Hitler did. And the war continues to be waged by those who took us into it or by those who have succeeded them in office, even as the majority of Americans, and now come to regard it as a very tragic mistake, if not a folly, and who wanted to end it forthwith. Knowing that, however, it is still imperative that we honor the lives of our fellow citizens that have been lost over the past 4 years. I believe we're up over 3,400 by that count now. For even if this war is folly, their lives clearly were not. Their lives mattered deeply. Deeply to those who loved them, to those who knew them as sons or daughters or fathers or mothers or husbands or wives. For no one, I feel, dies in vain. Any life that touches and blesses other lives is one that is not lost in vain or for no reason, whatever the circumstances of the death may be. These lives must be honored. And it is for this reason that I will join for a time tomorrow with those on Library Hill to read the names of fallen Americans in this war. But what should these lives mean to us? To those of us who have no personal ties to them, For those of us who may not know the person behind the name, for those of us who haven't even been called to make the minimal levels of sacrifice as our ordinary citizens were during the Second World War. Recall MacLeish's words again. Our deaths are not ours, they are yours. They will mean what we make them. These soldiers were sent to fight in our name. Whether or not we approved of the reasons, or even believed the reasons that were being sent, that were being given for their being sent. MacLeish writes that lives and deaths may be given for what he called a new hope. And this is what I find myself looking for. I find myself looking for it beyond the frustration, beyond even the anger I feel as I see this war continue. What is the new hope that might be found? For is there such a thing? I want to believe there is. For I continue to believe in the existence of hope that lies beyond even the deepest despair. And my hope is that the memory of these precious lives that have been lost will remain etched in our minds and hearts, and in the minds and hearts of generations to come, when the temptations and inclinations of war present themselves again, even as they do to this day. One of the tragic paradoxes of living is that we sometimes have to pass through the demonic in order to see and recognize all that is sacred and holy. The names that will be read over this weekend have been taken by the demons of war. In the wake of their passing, I hope we can renew and recommit ourselves to upholding all that we find sacred and holy in life. Rededicate ourselves to the preservation of all life. And if these deaths can call us to that kind of a renewed commitment, as I believe they can, they have not been lost in vain at all. One more note along this line. If we believe in the existence of such a thing as a human family, as I do, then the names of each of those lost in this war do represent a death in the family. And so do the names of tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians who have lost their lives, either at the hands of combatants or in the horribly convoluted and horribly multi-tiered civil war that has erupted in the wake of our invasion and refuses to diminish. For these Iraqi civilians caught in war's maelstrom, their family too, we should honor their lives. And in so doing, we should call upon ourselves to go on being bearers of life, even in the face of the many deaths that confront us. I have one more line from a MacLeish's poem that I want to return to as a way of now bringing these thoughts to a close. Because for me, it is the most intriguing line of all. It's the one where he writes, again, taking the voice of the soldiers, "We have given our lives, but until it is finished, no one can know what our lives gave." Until it is finished. Remember, he wrote this when the war was over. He wrote this when a war was finished. So what was it, what is it that MacLeish is referring to as not finished, until it is finished? Well, never having had a chance to ask him, I'll have to venture my own guess or speculation. Maybe what's not finished is the cessation of war itself. How many wars to end all wars have been fought in human history? Maybe what's not finished is the healing of the broken parts of ourselves or the broken parts of our collective selves as a human race that still prevent us from finding nonviolent solutions to our human conflicts. What is still not finished is the full realization of our sixth Unitarian Universalist principle that calls upon us to come to it, that calls us to covenant to affirm and promote the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. I think those who framed that principle, and I had a very, very small role in that overall process over 20 years ago, I think they were wise to use the word goal. For to set a goal means that something is not yet achieved, not yet attained. Framing it that way, I believe, took the principle out of the realm of pie in the sky and made it a human challenge. Our challenge and our calling is to work towards the goal of world community, for this is what remains unfinished. The night before he was killed, Martin Luther King told a gathering in Memphis, after referring to the promised land of racial justice and equality in a nonviolent world, echoes of the distant land the choir sang about earlier, he referred to that promised land, and Martin Luther King said, "I may not get there with you." Indeed, he didn't. He lost his life the next day. And we are still not there. And that's why the journey to that promised land or that distant land has to be, for each of us, a journey of faith, because we're most likely not going to get completely there ourselves. But we must still, each in our own way and in our collective way, travel towards it. And part of that traveling calls for the honoring of lives given, of lives sacrificed, precisely because that journey to that land is not finished. Because we have not fully reached our goal of a peaceful, sane, and reconciled world. Our deaths are not ours. They are yours. They will mean what you make them. What we must make of them, what we must take from them, is a renewed call and a renewed commitment in our own lives to plant the seeds, just plant the seeds, of peace, love, and justice, in the hope and in the faith that they will someday come to full flower, whether we see that full flowering or not ourselves. For all lives lost in this and in previous wars, may they rest in peace. And may those of us who have still been granted the gift of life be bearers of peace. Let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 139, "Wonder Still the World Shall Witness."